Thank you for joining us, ladies and gentlemen. We are live Saturdays, 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern, from Studio M in Los Angeles. I am Stephen Spear, and this is TalkRadio1.com for Saturday, the 22nd day of October, 2022. My email address, steve@talkradio1.com, steve@talkradioone.com. Today, my guest is Ken Walsh, adjunct professor of communication at American University in Washington, D.C., and an award-winning journalist who serves as a contributing White House analyst for U.S. News and World Report and is the author of about 10 books. He's covered the White House for U.S. News and World Report since 1986, so that includes presidencies of every president, starting with Ronald Reagan. Ken has been kind enough to join me for 9 times over the past decade. Douglas Brinkley, who is a leading historian, who's been a guest on this show and will be again very soon, has written, "No journalist today covers United States presidential politics with the same bedrock, self-assurance, analytical thought, and literary aplomb as Ken Walsh." You can find out more about Ken at www.kenwalsh.com. And in the meantime, it's my pleasure to say, Ken Walsh, welcome back for the 10th time to TalkRadio1.com.
Good. Happy to be with you again, Steve. Always enjoy it.
What is the mood at the White House right now, 18 days before the November 8 election?
Running scared. There's a number of polls that have come out in the last week or so, which show that there's now a surge in support for Republican candidates in some of these close races, that after a summer in which the surge seemed to be on the Democratic side for a number of reasons, the perception that Republican candidates were extreme, the sense of the Supreme Court decision on abortion, and other factors, but now it's flipped. And so there's polling indicating that it's the Republicans who are now doing better. And this is really, in the way these things work, this is really the time to do better, because we only have about 3 weeks left until the midterm. So I would say the White House is in a way running scared right now.
How did that happen?
Well, I think the Democrats and the White House have had problems with their messaging for quite a while now, but it's only really now showing itself as these midterms approach, and it would be considered a calamity for the Democrats if they lost both the House and Senate, and that's very possible. And it's always been possible, but the Democrats had a lot of hope during the summer in particular that they could reverse that historical trend where the out party, the party of opposing the president's party in the White House, does better in the midterms. That's a very clear historical trend. There was evidence that the Democrats might defy that trend, but now it looks back like that we might be going back to the historical norm where the out party does well, and that would benefit the Republicans.
You say that it's been a significantly a messaging problem, which seems like an understatement to me. It's sort of like saying that water is damp. It seems to me like the message has been utterly confused, and I've been hearing multiple sources. I go out of my way to listen to the right. I don't mean the far right, the nut right. I mean the conservatives and the Republicans in leadership and the left. And I don't mean the far left. I mean the liberals and the Democrats. And when I listen to them, I hear the Democrats or the Republicans, for that matter, their messaging. My two-year-old youngest granddaughter can do a better messaging than what they're doing.
Well, I have a 10-year-old granddaughter, and I think she would be the same.
But, yeah.
But I think that I'm a nonpartisan journalist, and so I hope people do not know my politics. But I do feel that in this case, maybe I was being a little bit too gentle in that analysis, but I'm just trying to be nonpartisan. Also, the other thing is in Washington and in the big media centers, I always have sort of a default notion that people aren't paying as much attention to this stuff as we do. And so maybe some of the stuff is just not sinking in. But in the case of what I was just talking about, the reason there's such jitters and worry in the Democratic Party and the White House is because I think a lot of these issues have sunk in. And just what you're saying, Steve, the voters are wondering, particularly independent voters, well, what is the Democratic position on this stuff, such as inflation, such as crime, such as
overspending by the government or support of Ukraine?
Support of Ukraine. And it's of concern. And I know the Democrats, and this was true at the Obama White House, and it's true now at the Biden White House. Of course, Biden was Obama's vice president. But there was always a sense that if you talked about things getting better, that would alienate people whose lives are not getting better, that you're being Pollyannish. But I think people need to hear that message. If things are getting better, the White House needs to speak up on that. Biden's starting to do that, but it might be too late for this cycle.
You know, you say that you don't want people to know your politics. And I've had you on this show this is the 10th time, and you and I have spoken off the air at length, and I don't know your politics. So you're doing a good job. There are moments when I think, that sounds slightly liberal. And then there are other times, no, he's slightly conservative. And I can never get a beat on it. And I've never asked you directly, and I don't intend to now or ever, because I do believe that it is a central function of journalism, not commentary, but journalism, to strive to try to set aside personal views. And I see the commentators, or I should say the journalists, who really try. You can't always succeed, and it comes through especially when there's a good deal of contemporaneous speaking, not a planned out article or essay or even a book.
Right.
But it's very hard to do, and it requires constant effort. It's why I listen to both sides all the time, because I want to, anytime I think I figured it out, I want to upset that and try to look at the other side again, which brings me to Barack Obama, who you mentioned. One of the things I try to do is to listen to both the conservative and liberal. So on the conservative side, I'm a regular listener to Ben Shapiro at Daily Wire. On the liberal side, I'm a regular listener to Pod Save America, which I think is probably one of the best on that side. And I think Shapiro is one of the best on the conservative side. And I want to distinguish that from the Rachel Maddow's or Tucker Carlson's of the world, who are, they are commentators, and I don't think they're liberal or conservative. I think they tend to be farther left and farther right. That's an understatement. And I listened to an hour-long conversation with Barack Obama on Pod Save America. Now, the hosts of Pod Save America, Jon Favreau, Dan Pfeiffer, Tommy Vitor, John Lovett, they are former Obama staffers. One was the chief speechwriter. Another one was high up in the comms department. Maybe you knew better than I do what those.
Yes.
So those are, and so they had their former boss, Barack Obama, on the program for an hour. And the title of the thing came out to be something like Advice for Democrats. And I was shocked at how clear he was in what he said. He said that politics can be made too complicated by leaders, and he thinks that's what's happening with the Democrats. And this comes back to your point, Ken Walsh, about the messaging problem. He says when Democratic candidates say that people are worried about prices and inflation and rising taxes because rich people are being greedy, it ignores the tremendous number of normal people, who probably a majority of the people, who are concerned about the price of a gallon of milk or a gallon of gasoline, who are trying to get out of debt or stay out of heavy debt or to maybe save for college or, you know, perhaps think about taking a vacation or buying something that they'd really like to buy, and they're struggling instead to pay for groceries. And when the culture war or the war over more esoteric issues, which are deeply important, like, oh, say, democracy and the survival and thriving of democracy, but are more complicated, that they lose the audience.
Right. That's true. And I always was struck, having covered Obama, on how sensible he was on a lot of things and how common sense. I mean, he had the ability to step back and to assess himself and what was going on in almost an objective way. Of course, he always had a Democratic template, but he was able to step back. And that process is not done enough in Washington, including by those of us in the media who follow politics and government. And but I think that to me, just as a corollary of that, the Democrats often come across as scolds. And now the Republicans are doing that more and more in their own way. But it goes to the point, I think, that there's not enough of that stepping back process of what are people going through. And, you know, what we think of, used to think of as the kitchen table issues. Now, Biden tries to address this by constantly talking about his upbringing, his Scranton, Pennsylvania history, the advice from his father and his mother and that sort of thing. But it seems like ancient history to people. There are examples he could be using from life today, not from life when he was a boy in Scranton, Pennsylvania, two generations ago.
So smart. And, so smart. What a plain, I have never thought of that. But now that you say it, it's so plain and obvious, where you have a man who's close to 80 years old who's talking about his parents and the lessons he's learned. And but boy, there are so many things that could be said about today. It's tremendous.
Yeah, well, thank you. And, you know, the other thing I'd mention, sort of a media point, is I've been in journalism for a very long time. And I used to feel, when I first got into the business out in Denver, I used to cover politics and government out in Denver. And then I came to Washington. I used to feel that I was living the same life as my readers. I was a middle-class guy. I had a family. I was experiencing the same problems people were having with property taxes and with inflation and with that whole stagflation notion we used to talk about interest rates and all. I don't feel journalists in Washington or politicians who've been here a long time live the same lives as most people are readers, listeners, and viewers, or the constituencies of the politicians. And I think that's a real problem. And I think that's one problem that the Democrats are having now in finding current examples that are natural to see if you are paying attention to the way people are living, that illustrate the point you're trying to make about policy, such as inflation, such as the idea of diversity and sort of even civil rights and such. I think we've lost track of that. And I think a lot of my colleagues in journalism don't like to admit that, but I think that we have lost our grounding in a lot of ways. And I think that perhaps that's a problem that President Biden is having, the isolation of the White House and of having spent 40 years, now close to 50 years, in government. Maybe he's suffering from that too.
On Sundays, I record all five of the Sunday shows, Face the Nation, Meet the Press, This Week, Fox News Sunday, and State of the Union on CNN. And then I watch them while walking high atop my electric treadmill on Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. And I watch them all. And what I have noticed is that the hosts of those shows, Jake Tapper, Chuck Todd, Margaret Brennan, now Shannon Bream on Fox, and George Stephanopoulos or Martha Raddatz on ABC's This Week, all seem frustrated. Now, maybe that's just my imagination, So my question is, what's the mood of the press right now, 18 days before the November 8 election?
Well, I think very clearly the mood is a lot of concern about our credibility in the media. Do we really know what's going on? And that goes to the idea of polling. There's a lot of challenges for pollsters. The best pollsters will admit this. And that's a whole subject to talk about at some point. But basically, there's a lot of questions about whether the polls pick up what's really going on for a number of reasons. And so, like a lot of journalists are wondering, are we getting this election wrong? Do we understand the strength of this current Republican apparently surge? Is that being overdone? And so a lot of people are at sea really in the media about, do we really know what we're talking about, to put it in blunt terms? And I think that's what you're seeing. And you see that all over the place in Washington. People in journalism who I respect and people who I respect most, understand this, that, you know, there's a lot of jitters that we really aren't feeling, aren't experiencing, aren't understanding what's going on in the country. And that really bothers journalists because we like to think we're connected. The question is, are we? And we'll know a lot more about that in the midterms.
You know, you mentioned polling as part of that. And I think the polls have shown themselves these last few elections, I guess I would say starting in certainly in 2016, but maybe as early as 2012 or 2010, have shown themselves to be really not very useful, really not very reliable. And there are a couple of things that they test that I don't even think should be tested because they're so easily misunderstood. One is right track, wrong track, because something like 70 or 75% of the people think the country's on the wrong track. The other one's democracy. Let me take right track, wrong track first. I think that when I speak with people who are clear Trump supporters, they believe in straight down the line what Trump stands for, and I speak with people on the exact opposite side who believe that the Republicans are evil and stupid or both. And when they all agree that the country's on the wrong track, but they mean utterly different things. In democracy polling as to whether democracy is endangered, you again get very high numbers of people who think democracy is in danger. But when you look at it from the left, they think that means voter suppression and growing authoritarianism and everything Trump stands for. And on the right, the threat to democracy stands for voter fraud and stolen elections and growing authoritarianism from the left. They think this on the right. And when I talk to people who are moderates, center left, center right, they think the danger to democracy is corruption in government, incompetence of government, overregulation for the people who are running small businesses. And these people, I can't even tell until I ask them if they think they are more Democrat or more Republican. They just hate the government because it interferes with their business. I'm talking about my barber, right, my car mechanic, the clients. I'm a practicing real estate and business attorney. The clients of mine who are in contracting and real estate development, and who just are crushed by fees, huge fees and regulations that just hamper them. A quick story: my son, who is a licensed architect and has 13 full-time architects working for him here in Southern California, doing a great job. He is now designing a house for a client in Rhode Island.
Oh.
And when he talked with the local architect who he engaged there to deal with local regulations, and he said, so when we go before the planning commission And the architect there said, we're not going in front of a planning commission. He says, well, when we run into objections to what we're planning, well, there won't be any of those. And the list went on. And as a result, if you're trying to build a house in most of the cities in California, you have to figure on a year and a half minimum before you can get approval and break ground. And in Texas or Rhode Island, you can probably, once the design is done by the architect, you can probably start building in a couple of months. So the issue of polling democracy or polling right track, wrong track, with regard to the credibility and whether the press knows what's going on, give me your thoughts on all that.
Well, on the right track, wrong track, I became very, very familiar with this from Richard Werthlin, who was Ronald Reagan's pollster. A terrific pollster, a very decent man in many ways, conservative, but really was trying to find the truth about what was going on in the country. So I did come to respect Richard Werthlin. And he explained this concept of right track, wrong track. But I think over time, and I used to think that was a good question to ask, but I've come to a different conclusion now. I basically agree with you, but for somewhat different reasons. One thing that has always struck me is, looking back on it, if we had polls during Franklin Roosevelt's presidency, during the Depression, let's say, or during the early part of World War II when we were losing, people would have said, we're on the wrong track. But that doesn't mean that they didn't think Roosevelt was doing a good job. And so I always think of that example when I look at that polling number again, which is still something of a Bible type of a thing for pollsters. They always ask that same question. But as you say, the reasons for right track, wrong track are completely different for different people in different parties and different partisan outlooks. So it's really not telling us a lot anymore. And I think that's one thing. And the other is the whole notion of living like people, everyday people do. And you have an example in your family with your son that you gave. I have examples in my family. I have four brothers and I have a large extended family, and I have two kids and a granddaughter. I always try to keep in contact with them. So what happens a lot of times in Washington is you have, and this happens to politicians too, you have people you touch base with outside of Washington to find a sort of a check on your own perceptions of things, to find out what's going on. And my brothers are all over the country and my kids are too. And so they talk about things that we don't see in Washington. I mean, this idea of the homeless problem, we have some of that in Washington, but one of my brothers lives in Seattle. It's constant out there. And you know, it really rattles people to see. And in California, with you have these giant homeless encampments. We don't see that in Washington, but it's very real to a lot of people. And there's a lot of issues that happens on, and that we don't get it. So that's, to me, one thing we need to do more in journalism and politicians, for that matter, is to get out in the country more than we do. And I think that would help. It's not a panacea, but get out there and talk to people and find out how people are really living and what they're doing. And I'm not talking about just focus groups. I'm talking about spending a couple of weeks and traveling around and getting a sense of things. And I used to do that when I was earlier in my career, when I worked in Denver. I would travel all around the Rocky Mountain states trying to get a sense of the mood of the voters and the mood of people. And it was very, very helpful. That's rare now. And a national journalist who used to do this is David Broder. He made a whole career about getting out around the country and talking to people.
He was great.
Yeah. Unfortunately, you don't see much of that anymore.
No, you don't. The New York Times put out a series of polls this week it sounds like you and I have both looked at. And 71% of the voters say that democracy is under threat. Okay, back to my point about that. 71% say democracy is under threat. 17% talk about government corruption in terms of Trump and the Republicans, political violence, election denial, but 68% characterize government corruption as government not working on behalf of the people, seizing power, seeking power, a government that tells people what to do, how to behave, what to do, what not to do, and having a government that doesn't work for ordinary people, but only works for the rich and for those in government who are powerful.
Right.
And
right.
What that brings me to is a similarity, and you can't draw many, but a similarity between Barack Obama and Donald Trump. In 2008, Barack Obama beat every member of the Democratic establishment to get the nomination.
Right.
And in 2016, Donald Trump beat every member of the Republican establishment to get the nomination. Both said they were outsiders. Both ran against the Washington establishment. Both ran against government inefficiency, government ineffectiveness, government corruption. They have that in common.
Right. Well, you know, that's an interesting point. We always manage to find interesting points when you and I talk.
Yes.
A couple of things I wanted to mention. One is the history of the outsider. It came really into being really, Jimmy Carter was an outsider. He was the governor of Georgia. He ran as an outsider. He was going to take on the powers that be. And the people liked that about him. And that's when people were, you know, we had a whole history of anti-establishment movements, and he was connected to the anti-war movement and counterculture and all. And he capitalized on that. Then he came to Washington, and a lot of the establishment Democrats, particularly those in Congress, really did not help him. And he was sort of soloing it there for a while, and it really hurt him. But what I'm getting at is the outsider tradition. You had Carter, you had Ronald Reagan, who was the Westerner riding in, and he loved that image of the outsider from California riding in to take on the establishment and take on Washington. Now, of course, he had been part of the corporate establishment for a long time as a politician and as a speaker and as a radio commentator. But basically, that was the image he had. And to some extent, it was true. Bill Clinton, another outsider, he was the governor of Arkansas. He was not a Washington insider, although he was part of the establishment in Arkansas. You have, you know, the number of governors. I mean, George Bush, the son, tried to be a Washington outsider, a governor of Texas, who sort of turned against some of his father's Brahmin connections. And, of course, Obama, as you mentioned, another outsider, the first African-American president. And so there's a lot of history to this, and Trump. And so we have had a lot of history. And this is a very compelling movement, really, is the outsiders coming into Washington to change things and clean up the place. And that's Trump is still pushing that. Now, the country turned to Joe Biden, who was an ultimate establishment guy, although he had roots in the middle class and the working class, as you mentioned, the Scranton, Pennsylvania connection and so on. But he has not updated that outsider notion. And now he's, I think, seen as an insider, which he is. So I think that there's a history to this, and it is a very compelling notion from a lot of Americans, is the lure of the outsider. Whether it's real or not in the individual cases is another discussion. But the concept of outsiders reforming Washington is still very compelling to people. So, and I think we're going to see a lot more of that in the presidential campaign that's emerging for 2024, the outsiders. And that would play into the idea of Biden's too old, we need new blood. So there's a lot of issues that fall under that umbrella. The other quick thing I'd mention is, having done a number of books on the presidency, I had the occasion to study a lot of what Richard Nixon did. Richard Nixon actually was a very brilliant politician in many ways. He couldn't carry things out personally the way others might have, but he had really some brilliant perceptions. And one of them gets back to the idea you talked about simplicity that Obama said, that as you described a few minutes ago, we need to not make things so complicated. Nixon had a thing he did with his speechwriters where he said to them, this was explained to me, by the way, by Lee Atwater, who was one of the most negative politicians you've ever had.
Sure.
And he saw this happen firsthand. Nixon would say, when I go into the briefing room in the press room, I want everything I'm going to say to be contained on a 3x5 card, one side, not both sides. And so he insists that his speechwriters give him literally a postcard size piece of paper with these comments on him. And he said, if it was one word over, he'd throw it back. And he said, no, that was a soundbite. He understood the concept of a soundbite, and that's not what he called it, but that's what it was. And so time and again, what he was trying to do is to boil things down in an understandable way and in a way that he could make his points without the media interjecting it themselves and editing it. So he wanted unfiltered. So he figured if it was on one side of an index card, the media would let him speak that without interrupting him or putting an analysis on it. And so that's one example where he was, I think, pretty perceptive. But also it gets to the point of Obama, don't keep things so complicated. So we have had politicians who understood this. I always have felt with Biden is that he doesn't really get that very much. He does sink into the Washingtonese and describing ideas in terms of bill numbers and its sponsors and all. That's really not – President Reagan understood not to do that, but President Biden does not.
And occupational hazard of having been a senator for a half a century,
yes,
is that you talk like a senator when you're the president.
Yes, exactly. But he needs to shake himself out of that, or somebody needs to do that. Maybe he's too proud to admit he needs to change his how he frames things. But he certainly has a long way to go to fix it.
So some of the old time Republican issues from back in the time of Nixon seem to be coming back. Give me your thoughts there.
Yes. Well, ever since Nixon, we had the Republicans time and again turning back to the idea of fear of crime. That's the law and order. That's sort of the shorthand. The idea of crime in the streets. We will take care of you, Republicans say. We will keep things safe. The Democrats are weak on crime. They're not interested in taking care of people, of everyday people. That's one. The other is on the economy. Cut taxes. This is part of the Republican old-time religion, the conservative orthodoxy. Cut taxes, cut the deficit, give free business to do what it does and to create jobs and so on. So the Republicans are coming back to that this cycle, and it's working, apparently, through the polls. Now, again, I've already been trying to be cautionary about the polls. But it does appear that some of this is working through Republicans again. Very basic Republican strategy. And it seems to be coming back now. And it's still time for the Democrats to address it more effectively. But so far, they're not.
In good times, it seems that Democrats have more available space and more running room to talk about issues that are more popular on the liberal side. So talking about helping minorities, talking about gay rights, talking about getting more people to vote, talking about letting more people into the country and so forth. In good times, you can talk about those things, and people can actually have long discussions about who gets to use what bathroom.
Right.
And when things are difficult, then it turns away from the Democrats. I think that might be the phenomenon we're seeing. We had 2% inflation, insignificant, unimportant inflation, for nearly 20 years. And maybe you could argue even closer to 35 years, but now that inflation is back, it's different. We have very low crime, led in many ways by Rudy Giuliani and the broken windows policy in New York, followed by Michael Bloomberg, then followed by many law enforcement officials and political leaders across the country. And then that, again, in good times, when crime was very low, the police are more criticized more plainly for the things that they need to be criticized for. Bad policing, poor training, insufficient instruction and screening of who actually becomes a police officer. But then what happens is they berate the police. It's hard to get police. Police leave. Police stand by and say, look, I'm not going to interfere with that problem over there because I'll just get in trouble. And then crime rises, which again gives rise to crime. And so you have that. And when you have this horrible inflation, which really doesn't hurt rich people, it annoys rich people, but the middle class is just beleaguered by this because they really have to pick between their medications and their groceries, or between going and driving to see grandma because it takes gasoline versus what are we going to eat for breakfast on Tuesday. And there's a lot of that going around. And then even the wage increases, which are controversial and difficult, don't make up for it. They still fall behind. Right. So in the big picture, good times tend to favor Democrats in the more liberal social agenda, and bad times, hard times, crisis times tend to disfavor Democrats and favor Republicans in the law and order, broken windows, let's restore peace and stability, let's restore affordable prices, people tend to look toward Republicans. First, do you agree with that? And second, is it accurate? Are Republicans better at that? Are Democrats not as good at that?
Yeah, well, I think that there's a sort of a tangled history on that, because for a long time, I think the middle class in America was willing to forgive the Democrats just about anything, because people felt the Democrats were looking out for the little guy type of a thing. And I know that President Kennedy was a good example of that. President Roosevelt, two rich men from privileged backgrounds who the public came to think were on their side. And I always remember having studied Franklin Roosevelt quite extensively. When he died, there was a famous incident where his body was being taken from his home in Warm Springs, Georgia, up to his permanent home in Hyde Park, New York, on a train. And there were massive crowds, and people were weeping and tremendous grief in the country. How are we going to get along without Franklin Roosevelt? And a reporter went up and asked the guy who was weeping at one of these stops, I see how moved you are by the death of President Roosevelt. Did you know him? And the guy said, I didn't know him, but he knew me. And I that's always stuck with me all these years.
Me too.
It's about the best epitaph a politician can have, don't you think?
Absolutely. That was so powerful. I've seen it quoted and requoted many times. That is the pinnacle of an achievement for a politician, to actually have people think that you know who they are.
Right, exactly. And how many people would say that of a politician today? It would be very rare, I think. And that's something we've lost, unfortunately. But I think that the other thing I mentioned, Steve, is in that litany of things you talked about that people might consider in good times but not in bad. Another is environment and climate change. In good times, I think people might be more willing to consider taking steps on climate change or on the environment and so on. You're seeing an erosion of support, by the way, at least in the polls, for environmental types of things, such as not using coal, such as, you know, emission standards for cars and all that sort of thing. So that is a very good point. But I think it gets back to the idea of who capitalizes on this better? And right now, I think the Republicans seem to understand that more. People are willing to forgive a lot of candidates, personal flaws, hypocrisy, values problems, if they think that they're closer to the to understanding what everyday people are going through, or at least have an instinct for it. And by the way, I think that's part of why Herschel Walker in Georgia is hanging in there. He's still in a very close race, despite all the problems he's having with the character issue, with treating his family, with abortion. That race is tied. And I think he is exactly
who you brought to mind with the comments just before you mentioned his name, because here he is, a deeply flawed candidate with things that in decades past would have just ended a campaign. It would be over. It would be out. It would be done. And yet I'm seeing man on the street interviews in Georgia, one after another saying, yeah, he's no great shakes. He's not a very good human being, but he's a vote in the Senate.
Right. There is that. And there's also, you know, he was a very popular football player, and the people came to love him as a football player. And they feel like, well, okay, you know, this part of a person we don't like. But again, it's interesting. They call him by his first name. That's all. Just Herschel.
Yeah.
So people feel they know him. And now that they feel maybe he's a scoundrel in private, but he could be okay as a senator, and he at least would give the conservatives another vote, as you say. And so people are the character issue has faded as an important issue in Herschel Walker's case.
Now, maybe it'll come back. Saw a man on the street interview in Georgia on that, and a woman said, I would not want him as a father. I wouldn't want him as a brother. I wouldn't want him as a son. But I'm going to vote for him, even though I don't like him, because he's a vote. And what about character? She was asked the character. She says I can't afford to vote on the basis of character.
Right.
That was unimaginable 20 years ago. Right. Unimaginable.
Right. Exactly. Yeah, exactly. And, in recent years, we hear these things, and people of a certain age like you and I, who've been around this business for a long time, looking at politics and government, our first instinct would be, well, that does it. Now, it can't survive this. But Donald Trump has shown us that they do survive it, that if you understand the grievance and the resentment and the anger, you can overcome these character problems. And Trump has done it and still does it. And Herschel Walker has done it. And you're seeing this happening in a lot of these candidates around the country.
Well, and you're also seeing it back in 2008 when Barack Obama was heard talking about bitter clingers clinging to their guns. To guns and religion. And I thought, oh boy, this is going to be a big problem. Or Jeremiah Wright, his minister.
Yes. Right.
And I thought, oh boy, no, because he was able to get the message across. Barack Obama was that he was going to be there to challenge the establishment and to do things differently. And that's how Trump survived the Access Hollywood tapes, the Grab'em tapes, where it didn't make any difference to the people who were focused on, we need this anti-establishment candidate, Barack Obama or Donald Trump. Again, that's perhaps one of the few similarities they have, but that seems to reflect the deep anger in the country and the disappointment overall in government.
Right, exactly. Well, I mean, another race in which this is distilled is in Arizona, the governor's race with Carrie Lake.
Yeah.
If you see her ads, she is absolutely ferocious in talking about taking on the establishment, taking on the media. There's one ad she has where she has literally a sledgehammer and she's slamming the sledgehammer into the screens of televisions.
Yeah.
And it's totally about taking on the corrupt media. It's part of her anti-establishment message. And I think she would follow up on that if she's elected governor. Her Democratic opponent is sort of holding back and is not addressing this stuff. And now Carrie Lake, who was behind in that race substantially, is now ahead. And so it's working out there. And you know, I mean, again, we have to be careful about the polls, but Carrie Lake is sort of the distillation of resentment, anger, and grievance in these midterm campaigns, and she's doing actually very well with that issue.
Her opponent, Katie Hobbs, who I listened again to a long-form interview on Pod Save America with Katie Hobbs, makes perfect sense when she talks and is being very careful not to sound angry or outraged or, you know, pick up a sledgehammer to a television set.
Right.
And it doesn't seem to me that it is speaking to the Democratic voters who actually believe that the government is letting them down and isn't the place to turn to for help.
Right. Right. And I have yet to see an adequate explanation of why Katie Hobbs is not understanding that. I mean, is she just getting bad advice? Does she not have an instinct for this sort of thing, or where the people are and what people want from the governor in her state? Maybe it's all of the above. But I think, again, we have about 3 weeks left. She could have a dramatic surge in taking on this idea that portraying Carrie Lake as an extremist is going to make things worse, which is a natural argument you could make in straight up political terms. But I don't see signs that she's going to do that.
I don't either. The only Democratic candidates that I can see who actually have learned to speak like Trump or like Carrie Lake, and again, that's not something I think is a good thing to aspire toward, but it did seem to get Trump elected in 2016. The only Democrats I see who are really doing that are Stacey Abrams in Georgia, who appears to be losing badly to Brian Kemp for the governorship for the second time, and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who in Congress is in a district where if you get the nomination and you are the Democrat, you are elected. So she doesn't have to worry about not winning the general election. All she had to do is make sure she was far enough to the left that she didn't get outflanked on the left by a primary, in a primary. But she speaks like Trump, and Stacey Abrams speaks like Trump in these strong terms that I think help people identify with him. It isn't working, though, for Stacey Abrams. Why do you suppose?
I think that, you know, Kemp did stand up against Trump. At least Trump criticized him. So there's a sense of that Kemp might have a sense of independence that voters prize. So I think the idea that he's a puppet of Trump, which Stacey Abrams wanted to portray him as, that's undercut by Trump turning against Kemp in many ways.
Yes.
And and so that's one thing. Another is, you know, that was a close race the last time, but I think a lot of people in Georgia think he's actually been a pretty good governor, just straight up in pragmatic terms. So he has a record as governor now. I think people feel like, well, it's hard to portray him as an extremist, given his record, what he's done, and how Trump has treated him. So I think that that's part of it. And I think that maybe Stacey Abrams is focusing too much on African-American support, and white people might feel there's not enough there to show that she's representing their interests. That might be part of it, too.
Well, possibly, and you make a great point with Brian Kemp, Georgia's governor. He's not an ideologue, and
right.
He proved that with his refusal to knuckle under to Trump. And he's been, as you say, pragmatic and practical and solving problems and actually moving things forward and making things better. And there's a lesson in there for politicians higher and lower across the country that being an ideologue is not necessarily a way to capture the middle, and it's the middle you have to capture to get elected. Everyone seems to be playing to their own base, like Carrie Lake with a sledgehammer, and Stacey Abrams with her, all of her positions. And if you play to the center of the room and you're not an ideologue, but you actually look like you might be capable of solving a problem or two, that might be the key in future elections. And I wonder why Democrats and Republicans don't just do that.
That's true. Well, I think part of it is that we're in an era where base politics, they bought into this notion that base politics is the way to win. You need to just play to your base. I mean, Bush, the son, George W. Bush, with Karl Rove as his guru, that was his whole mantra, base politics. Get your own base, and you can get that over 50%. That's all you need. Expanding the electorate is not where the public is right now. You're never going to get the Democrats and so on. Although, actually, if you look at it, Bush did pretty well with the Latino vote in those days. And now there's a sense, part of why the reasons are so nervous now is that there's a sense that the Latino vote now is becoming somewhat more Republican, still Democratic, but enough of an increase in Republican support, particularly in places like South Texas and even in Florida, not just the Cuban vote, but other Latinos, that this is causing some angst among Democrats. But I think the other thing is, having written a book, Leadership in Crisis, which you were kind enough to discuss on your show with me, what people want during what perceived as a crisis or difficult times, the first thing they want is bold action from the president or the leader. If you look at that way, somebody like Carrie Lake versus Katie Hobbs really isn't showing that bold leadership, bold decision maker capacity. She's not showing something she's willing to fight for and confront people over. I'm not saying she has to be nasty or she has to be insulting or bullying or whatever, but I think that's one problem I think she's got. She's got to show she's willing to stand up for something, and she's trying to be the reasonable candidate. And I think that only goes so far in a race where the other side is constantly picking fights and fighting. I think that people want to see a candidate stand up for something. And I think that's one problem she has.
I think you're right. What in the heck happened to abortion when Dobbs versus Jackson in June was handed down by the Supreme Court of the United States and overturned Roe versus Wade? It looked to me like a political disaster for the Republicans. It looked to me like the Democrats would be able to capitalize on that and keep it fresh through November, perhaps through 2024, and that the Supreme Court now finally at long last would really be on the ballot. I thought that this would absolutely energize Democrats, and it did for a while, and it seems to have been overcome by these other issues, crime and inflation and taxes and regulations and perhaps foreign policy in another direction. What happened?
I think that's one thing where we're trying, speaking the media collectively and the political folks, to figure out what happened. I think one thing is that people feel like it will be a state by state battle, and that's what we always knew would happen if Roe v. Wade was overturned. Abortion goes to the states. I think the danger for the Republicans remains, and this is something the Democrats should, I think, be focusing on as a matter of political strategy, is the kind of comments that Senator Lindsey Graham made, that we're going to take this and we're going to ban abortion nationally. And that, I think, remains an important issue. But I think people feel, well, if we have to fight it out in the states, we can deal with that. Once the Republicans start to talk more and more about banning abortion nationally, then I think that becomes an animating issue again for the Democrats. And that could happen, but I'm always surprised that how slow the Democrats are figuring this stuff out. There's less than 3 weeks left now. And the Democrats, if they're going to re-energize the people who are pro-choice on abortion, they need to do that right now. And they need to focus on the idea, if the Republicans take over, they're going to try to push for a national ban on abortion. I think that would put that issue front and center again. But I think the other thing is that people feel that inflation and crime and the other issues you mentioned, regulation, taxes, are here and now issues that they really need relief on right away. Abortion has to be fought out indefinitely. These other issues, whatever the answers are, they need to get them now to improve their lives. And I think that's the sense of more urgency on those other issues, particularly crime and inflation. And I must say, though, Steve, is that the Republicans don't have answers for this. I mean, a fair analysis is, how would they improve inflation? Well, they don't know. They're just talking about cutting taxes and cutting spending. That's the way we've been with this stuff forever. And there's no clear agenda of how they would make it better. It's just sort of people unhappy with what they have now and looking at the out party to fix it. But there's really no solutions that we can point to.
No, I think that's right. I don't think the Republicans are offering any suggestions that I've heard that make any sense. I mean, it makes sense. You stop so much government spending, which was right. One of the promoters of inflation. You stop that, and it'll help. But overall, it's going to take raising interest rates to the point where it crushes the economy and sends us into a recession. And the talk of soft landing is all but gone now, as it should have been from the beginning. And then you'll get inflation back under control. It's the only way. But no politician wants to come out and say, I'm going to raise unemployment. I'm going to crush the economy. I'm going to make it so bosses lay people off to save money because they don't want to pay higher wages and bring in more automation to replace people. Politicians can't say that. So, the Democrats have no inflation solution. The Republicans have no inflation solution, but that's what's got everybody upset. But that, in combination with the failure to manage crime and homelessness and homeless encampments in major cities, those are the things that end up hurting the Democrats. On the abortion thing, I think that the Republicans and the Democrats missed a fantastic opportunity to jointly join hands and offer a national amendment that would make abortion easy until sometime in the 22 to 24 week range, and make it very difficult, like life of the mother after that. And I am astonished that there is not one Democratic candidate who I've heard answer the question, do you believe there should be a number of weeks beyond which an abortion is no longer on demand? And you hear the answer, well, it should be between a doctor and a woman, and the government shouldn't tell people what to do. And then Major Garrett asked, I'm trying to remember who it was, one of the Democratic candidates, so if one of your constituents heard your answer and concluded that you are not in favor of any specific time limit on the availability of an at-will abortion, would that person be correct? And the candidate said again, well, I think it should be between a doctor and the mother, and it shouldn't be something that the government should be involved in. Rather than say, yes, there should be some limit, which is where most of the country is. Most of the country is not for total abortion ban or totally free abortion all the way through pregnancy. Politically, it would seem like you could get joint support. You'd lose the two extremes for sure, but you could get the center of the country to support a ban after 22, 23, 24 weeks, something like the Roe standard.
Right. I think so. And you know, if the Republicans do take over the Senate and the House, particularly in the Senate, I think there will be an effort to go too far in the conservative direction. In other words, ban abortion nationally. And so the idea of that pragmatic solution that you just mentioned, I think, would be even more distant if that happens. But the Democrats aren't making that point enough, I don't think.
No, I think you're right. We're at the top of the hour. Ken, do you have a few more minutes?
Yeah, I could stay for a little bit longer, sure.
Okay, so what is Joe Biden's destiny for the next 2 years if he does or does not run for re-election? If he says, I'm not running, or if he says, I am running, what is his destiny for the next 2 years?
That's a good question. I thought about that a lot. Basically, you know, Biden turns 80 years old next month. Biden is showing his age, and a lot of really diehard Democrats who I talk to all the time, in addition to Republicans, were unwilling to admit that he's showing some cognitive problem. It's not that he's got Alzheimer's or dementia. It's just that he's slowing down. He's an elderly man, and we have to acknowledge that. I mean, people slow down. The White House is not, I don't think, addressing that well enough. I mean, as I tell my classes, and I teach about this sort of thing these days, about presidential life and communication and so on, if Joe Biden runs out of gas after working 5 hours a day, then don't have him give big speeches in his seventh and eighth hours of the day. I mean, it gets pretty simple. But I think maybe he's too proud to listen to that or whatever. But you look, he does run out of gas, and that's when he has problems with reading texts and teleprompters and going off script. You have to understand the pacing of an individual president. Ronald Reagan understood this. He was an old man when he was elected. He turned 70 years old the month after he took office. Now, Biden is much older than that. But basically, that's one thing. So if Biden, regardless of what he decides to do, he's going to have that age question out there. If he decides not to run, he's a lame duck immediately. And I think that makes things much more difficult for him and really for the country, because you have this primal force in our politics, the presidency, which is diminished if a president's not running again. It's the lame duck thing. And who's going to pay attention to him if he's not going to be around? You know, he's not going to be around more than X number of months. It makes things much more difficult to find compromises and to have his party's ideas represented and so on. So that's a difficult thing. I think partly that's why he keeps saying, I intend to run and so on. So if he doesn't run, he becomes a lame duck. And that, I think, means that everything is frozen. I don't think you get much done once the president decides to do that, not going to run again.
Agreed. I agree completely, which is why I believe that Joe Biden and the White House are planning as follows. He's going to keep saying, I intend to run, but he's not going to announce all the way through the rest of this year and all of next year. I think either very late in 23 or early in 24, he will then say that he is stepping aside. And I believe he won't run. But I don't think you're going to hear that in any official capacity until probably the beginning of 24 or very late in 23, even though he'll be under enormous pressure from potential Democratic candidates who want to get organized and start getting fundraising and staffing and structure underneath them. I think that that's going to wait, and I do believe that's going to be a big disadvantage for the Democrats. Thoughts?
It is. Well, I think one proviso I'd have, though, on that is waiting until 2024. That would make it very difficult for Democrats to actually get on the ballot in primaries. They have to get. So to me, that decision has to be made openly in time for the for his successor, would be successors, to get on the ballot and run.
I stand corrected. You're 100% right. I didn't even think of that logistical problem. So that's going to make his decision come out probably no later than September of 23.
Yeah, because there are ballot deadlines. So, yeah. You know, I mean, he's an institutionalist. He doesn't want to cripple the candidates who might want to succeed him because they can't get on the ballot.
No, you're right. You're right. So I have to change it. He's going to wait as long as he can, but that's as long as he can wait.
Right. And so that would be okay. The party could deal with that. It might even create more of an excitement about that race. But in any case, so I think that I mean, I think that in the end, my personal view, really a hunch more than anything, is that I don't think he'll run. But I think that and I think your scenario deciding at the end of 2023, at the end of next year, makes sense that to do it that way. And but all the signs would be there, I think. I mean, people would know privately what is or isn't doing. And then you'd have people who were going to run would have to decide whether it's when they would announce. I mean, does it look like they're disloyal to announce before the president announces what he's going to do, even though it's expected he's not going to run? Anyway, that's a whole other series of questions. If he does run, then that makes this midterm issue even more important, because if he has a Republican Congress, he's going to be in for constant battles, whether he runs or not. But if he is running, I think we're in for a stalemate, and we're probably in for even more of a nasty environment, because there'll be efforts to dislodge him as a candidate from the Republican side and to damage his standing. So I think we're in for a very difficult situation. Can anything get done? The whole system might be frozen for the next 2 years. That could well happen.
My final major issue is Trump on the ballot, and do the Democrats need him? So when we see the campaign for governor, when Glenn Youngkin was elected, his opponent called him Trumpkin, tried to say he was a mini Trump. Stacey Abrams has tried in Georgia to paint Brian Kemp as Trump. We see plenty of people now who are attempting to paint Florida Governor Ron DeSantis as Trump. And Democrats have gone out of their way to try to help in some jurisdictions to get Trumpish and direct Trump endorsed candidates on the ballot, because they thought they would be easy to beat. What should the Democrats wish for? Should they wish that Trump runs and gets the nomination for 24 because they need him on the ballot to beat him the way Joe Biden did in 2020, because it was not Joe Biden who everybody said, gee, I'd love him to be president. It was more people who voted for Joe Biden didn't want Trump to be president. Should the Democrats wish for Trump to run so they can motivate their voters, or should they wish for Trump not to run?
Yeah, that's a very good question. But I would think that they should frame this whole notion differently. They should be prepared to run against him, whether he runs or not. They should be prepared for that and get everything ready, because as we've seen in some of these cases this year, the Democrats supported the more extreme candidates in primaries, Republican candidates, thinking they'd be easier to beat in general elections. Now it turns out that some of them can win. So it can boomerang against you. So I think that the Democrats, I think, have to be sort of looking at pragmatically how they would deal with Trump running or not. And by the way, I think Trump will run myself. And so I think they are going to have to deal. I do think he's going to run.
So do I.
Do you agree with that, by the way?
Yes, I think Trump will run. I think Trump will run almost certainly, because I cannot think of a reason he would not want to run. There are lots of reasons why I don't want him to run. I cannot think of a reason he won't want to run. So I think he runs. Final prediction, who carries the House? Who carries the Senate 18 days from now?
I think the Republicans will take the House. I think the Democrats will hold on to the Senate by maybe even, or maybe they'll gain one vote. I think that's I think that's
right with you. I think the Democrats, it's so razor close, but with all the variable factors, I agree with you. Republicans get the House, Democrats keep the Senate, but just barely and not nearly enough to get anything done, especially with a Republican House.
Exactly.
So
just as, yeah, but anyway, but so no, I think we agree on that. So I guess maybe that's the way to end our discussion.
Exactly. So you are working on a new book. Can Walsh tell us about that?
I'm working on a book about a history of toxic politics, attack politics, negativity, going back to the founders, the early days of our politics. After George Washington, our politics turned toxic very, very quickly with John Adams versus Thomas Jefferson. So I'm going to trace a history of toxic politics, making it clear that we've had this with us almost from the very beginning of the country. I think it's worse now than it's been, but it has been pretty bad. And I'm going to talk about the individual presidents who are most responsible for toxic politics and the independent operators, the people who are in the media, provocateurs in the business of politics, such as the direct mail people who have been very, very negative, and explain how we got to where we are today and what we might do about it.
I was delighted to learn that after COVID, which shut down all the cruises, that you are back on the Queen Mary 2. Tell me what you do there.
I am. Well, I speak on cruise ships. There was a hiatus when the cruise ships industry shut down because of the pandemic. Now they're reviving again. I'm going to be back on the Queen Mary the week before Thanksgiving. I give speeches. I try not to be pedantic. I try to be sort of entertaining and interesting to people. But I'm not partisan. But basically, they have what they call an enrichment program, which gives people the opportunity to hear speakers about topics that are important to the country and the world. And my participation is about the presidency and international issues and sort of what's happening about our presidency in the United States.
Ken Walsh, I want to say thank you so much for being with me today again here on TalkRadio1.com. We will have you back on again soon, and we will certainly have you back on to talk about that new book. I can't wait to read that book. That, I think, will help to contextualize the problems we're facing today to understand that there really is and should be strong hope and optimism about getting through these difficult times and entering another period of American greatness.
Yes, it can happen. But, well, thank you very much, Steve. I always enjoy talking to you.
Thank you, sir. My guest has been Ken Walsh. He is the author of a book that he mentioned, a bunch of books. He's been on this show many times to talk about them. And the most recent book was Presidential Leadership in Crisis, Defining Moments of the Modern Presidents from Franklin Roosevelt to Donald Trump. And as we talked about it on this show, through Joe Biden as well. So that book is called Presidential Leadership in Crisis. I strongly recommend that book. Buy that book, Presidential Leadership in Crisis. If you would like, ladies and gentlemen, links to the shows on which Ken has been a guest on this program, send me an email and I will be glad to send you an email with the links to the shows. These are, to me, some of the most important political conversations in which I can participate, because we actually talk about issues in a way that we don't hear them generally discussed in major media, and certainly not in social media. So I'll give you my email address in a moment. In the meantime, you can also find a great deal about Ken Walsh at kennethwalsh.com. That's www.kennethwalsh.com, W-A-L-S-H, kennethwalsh.com. My next show will be 2 weeks from today. My guest is going to be Sarah Peters, who is with Stand Together, which is a national charitable organization that helps solve problems in America. It's a non-governmental private charitable enterprise. And Sarah Peters is going to be talking about, if you will, a customer-first approach to breaking the cycle of poverty. Most of the programs centered on solving poverty programs are top-down. And this is a bottom-up, center-out approach, a customer-first approach to breaking the cycle of poverty. We should be able to see some great progress. That's 2 weeks from today. That's Saturday, November 5th, 2022, 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern. Use our PayPal link if you want to throw a few bucks our way to help support the fine programming here on TalkRadio1.com. Our Amazon links and our eBay links, those don't cost you anything when you use them from the TalkRadio1.com homepage. My email address, steve@talkradio1.com, steve@talkradioone.com. Thank you so much for listening today, ladies and gentlemen. I am Stephen Spear. Throughout the country and around the world, this is TalkRadio1.com.